Rabbi Gunstein, thank you for waking up as well early for us and waiting patiently. We're looking forward to hearing you.
Thank you, Rabbi Friedler, and it's wonderful to see you and to see Deb together. The last time I met you, you were not yet married. I met the rabbi in New Zealand.
Rabbi Gunstein was here for a quick visit of 48 hours after a conference in Australia, and he came last year. So we had a quick time together, and now live again.
And it's wonderful, Rabbi Friedler, that to see you together with Deb. If you recall then, you were not yet married, so I had to meet you in your community. And Deb, I had the pleasure of meeting in Melbourne as she went there to look for a wedding dress. So I'm very glad that you're sitting together and I could see you as a couple. The picture behind you is, as a matter of fact, that picture comes up when you call. So that's the picture that I saved on my phone. It's also a further pleasure to see everyone together with Rabbi Lawrence, who I have to admit is not just the former rabbi of your community, Rabbi Friedler. His shul is my go-to shul when I go to London, because I really don't know London from a hole in the head. I cannot get around without explicit instructions. The only place I know is Rabbi Lawrence's shul, the hotel across the street, and walking up towards the kosher eateries in Golders Green. If someone says something around that area, I know. So it's a pleasure to see you, Rabbi Lawrence, and a mazel tov on the new additions. And, of course, condolences on the yort site and all that you've unfortunately had this year. So, thank God, Zoom allows us to speak about Shavuos and about Torah, even though I'm in Israel and you're in New Zealand. You're about to go to sleep and I'm just about to begin my day. And Rabbi Friedler asked me to basically let you in on the very fascinating, I would say, first time ever questions that we got here from our rabbis around the world during COVID-19. Unfortunately, it's not over yet. In Israel, we've been opening up more and more like you've done in New Zealand. So questions are still coming in. But what I did was I tried to pinpoint some of the questions that I have to admit I don't believe were asked ever prior to this virus, or at least not in the last few hundred years prior to this virus. So let's begin. There's a community around the world, shall remain nameless, who always have a communal Seder. They couldn't do it this year. However, they had other problems, and I'll mention two. Number one, they didn't have enough kosher wine or kosher grape juice for the Seders. They had about 6, 7, maybe 12 people that asked this question, and they said, we don't have enough wine. Which of the four cups of wine should we, quote unquote, get rid of the wine on? The first cup, the second cup, the first night, the second night. That was question number one that we got, that we thought would be an easy question, because if you don't have wine, there are substitutes that you can use, even on Pesach, any important beverage for that matter. However, the next question...
Whiskey or beer, though.
I hope you don't drink whiskey on Pesach, absolutely, and beer would not be a good idea. But there's liqueur, there's other things that perhaps we can use, maybe yes, maybe not. The next question was even more fierce. They get a Pesach order every year from a certain community, and because there was no flying, there was no cargo, they had no Pesach goods. So they asked us, what can we buy in the store that doesn't have a Pesach stamp on it that we can use? Because quite frankly, none of the kosher for Pesach products have come in this year. And we're not talking about raw fish and things like that. We're talking about things that you need at home that every other year, the rabbi, the community said, buy with a kosher certificate. And this year, there was just no products. And finally, that same community asked the third question. Since no products are coming in, and we can make do, we have some spices, raw fish, vegetables, what's the one thing you need at the Seder that if you don't have it, you just don't have it?
Matzah.
No matzah is coming in. I'm not talking about shmura matzah not coming in. I'm talking about any matzah coming in. Can we have a Seder without matzah? Obviously, the simplest answer was, so bake matzah, flour, water, it's poor man's bread. It just cost a lot of money in the supermarket. But quite frankly, it's easy to make. The truth of the matter is that because of the various regulations, they couldn't get to the oven that could bake the matzah. And the ovens at home were not good enough to bring it up to the heat level that was possible. So eventually we got matzah experts to tell them how to do it, and they had matzah. With regard to the Pesach products, we also got them experts. With regard to the wine, I have to admit that they decided that the first cup of wine they're going to drink, and then they're going to leave another cup aside for the second Seder. And even though the second Seder is rabbinic and the first one's biblical, this particular mitzvah is rabbinic. However, they felt that even the second night, it's twice rabbinic. The whole Seder is rabbinic, and this is a rabbinic commandment within the Seder. They felt that if they didn't have Kiddush at the beginning with wine, that would ruin their entire Seder. So they took one cup of wine, covered it up, put it in the refrigerator, and saved it for the second night. It's like someone doesn't have any money whatsoever, he's saving that wine for a new occasion. So those are the first fascinating questions we got with COVID-19. And then, of course, the questions got more and more tragic. There was a community where the government said that anyone that died from COVID-19 has to be burnt. They can't be buried, they have to be burnt, because without cremation, the virus is going to spread. Obviously, we Jewish people bury, and we bury a whole body in the cemetery. In this particular case, they basically made a deal that Jewish bodies, the minute someone died, they would take the body out of the hospital as quickly as possible and deal with it. However, there was one day of the week they couldn't do that. Which day was that?
Shabbat.
The question was, can you violate Shabbat in order to bury someone in the ground? It's not simple at all. Shabbat is more important than burial. We know that because pikuach nefesh, guarding your life, is more important than dying for Judaism. And if on Shabbat someone puts a gun to my head and says, cook something, I cook something, because life is more important than Shabbat. However, in this case, there's no question that Shabbat is more important than burial. And the question was, what can we do? And eventually we got the chief rabbis involved, because we felt this was not a question for one community, and it's also going to be a question that's going to change the entire practice of Jewish law forever. And therefore we got the chief rabbis and others to sign on that they would try to process everything by a non-Jew, a point of view we never utilize with regard to burial on Shabbat, but in this case we had no choice for two reasons. Number one, we felt cremation was terrible, and number two, we were very worried that the less observant would see cremation as a legitimate way to bury within the Jewish community, because the rabbi says, I'm keeping Shabbat, let them cremate the bodies. He doesn't even do anything to stop it. And therefore, in that particular situation, that's what we told them to do, and that's what was practiced in many communities. As we were dealing with that question, we had a tragedy within our family. What do I mean, our family? Rabbi Nati and Deb are part of 161 rabbis that we have around the world that went through our institute, are associated with us. One of the 161 had a baby born with various medical problems, and unfortunately the baby died after a whole month of fighting for its life on the second day of Pesach. Now I want to explain to everyone what that meant. The second day of Pesach this year, if you recall, was part of a three-day yontiv for you and for everyone else around the world, except for in Israel. What was surprising was I got a phone call from him on the second day. And I personally tell all our rabbis to keep a second day as long as they're in their communities. So I was a bit surprised, but thank God I didn't mention anything. He said, our son just died. What do we do? And the truth of the matter is, on the second day of Yom Tov, as opposed to Shabbat, you could bury. And Jews can bury, for that matter. It's different than the first day, is different than Shabbat. And he asked what we should do. It was Friday. Obviously, very difficult to get anyone to do anything because no one's answering their phones. Nobody is on call. And we didn't know. So I'm in Israel, and I tried to do what I can. So I tried to call a rabbi in his community, and lo and behold, the rabbi answered the phone. So I was a bit surprised, and he told me that all the rabbis in the community left their phones on by virtue of them being rabbis and having to deal with situations like this, or depression, or other things that came up. And I asked him, how many times did the phone ring and it was an emergency? He said, in the last day and a half, with an exception of two wrong numbers, he had 15 phone calls that were literally life-endangering. When do you disconnect from a respirator? Who do you connect to a respirator? And obviously questions like this. To make a long story short, this particular family felt that they have to bury the body in Israel. Obviously, it's their son. They're going to live in Israel after they finish their emissary duties there. We advised them to bury there and move the body later. They refused. And I have to admit, the consulate of Israel, together with America, together with politicians, all did everything that within a few days, before the last days of Pesach, the baby was buried here in Israel. The family was allowed to go to the funeral and, of course, had to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. So in between answering questions for the rabbis, we had to answer a question for one of our rabbis who was in this terrible situation. So as I said, the beginning dealt with no matzah, no wine, and whatnot. As time went on, it got to these questions, unfortunately, which are tragic and part of where we're living. Indeed, in one of the communities, they said that they had enough Pesach food for the first days, but only enough, and they didn't have a chicken bone to put on the Seder plate. And here was the question. Can we use a non-kosher shake bone to put on the Seder plate? Now you have to understand that no rabbi in their right mind would tell anyone, bring non-kosher food into your house and put it on the Seder plate, because no problem. We all know that it's very easy to eat it because chicken looks like chicken. In this case, we felt that even though a shake bone is not the end all, you can have a Seder without it. We felt that since there's no communal Seder, and people are doing Seders alone, and they're anyway very, very sad and depressed and whatnot, we felt that they have to have the shake bone. So we advised in this situation to go ahead and to wrap the shake bone in a double wrap of plastic and write on it, "For show only." And indeed, after Pesach, I got a wonderful video of this particular community saying, "Here's the shake bone." 3 days went by, no one ate it, and they threw it in the rubbish. So that one ended up pretty nicely.
Very creative. Wow.
And indeed, these creativity had to continue throughout the time. We have a graduate in Norway. And like every country, I'm sure in New Zealand, no one was allowed in. And Baruch Hashem, they had a healthy baby boy born. What happens 8 days after the healthy baby born is born? I was always taught, after 8 days they get circumcised, and after 13 years they get circumscribed. So we're talking about the circumcised here. The difference between certain circumcised and circumscribed is as follows. If the bar mitzvah boy wanted to read the Torah, they could go on Zoom and read the Torah. However, a mohel is needed to do the brit, to do the bris. So a very same and similar question you had in your community with, I believe, your Bnei Akiva shlichim, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, yeah.
We had this situation way up in Norway, where a baby did not have a bris for a month and a half for the following reason. No mohel was allowed in unless the following things were done. He can come into the country and be quarantined for 2 weeks. 2 weeks and a minute, he would do the bris. And then 2 weeks and 2 minutes, he'd go back to where he comes from. Let's say England in this case. He'd come back to Rabbi Lawrence's community. Rabbi Lawrence would say to him, "Welcome back, get into quarantine for another 2 weeks." But what happened was, for one bris, a mohel would have to lose 4 weeks of his life. And needless to say, any mohel who took the oath of circumcising babies never thought it would be a 4 week ordeal. And therefore, they couldn't give the baby a bris. They couldn't give the baby a bris. Now, your Bnei Akiva shlichim understand that a bris is very important, albeit the baby's still Jewish. And when everything stops, and God willing, we'll all be healthy and well, we'll do the bris then. However, this particular family is living in a community where they really believed that without a bris, this baby's not Jewish. And it's like you have a non-Jewish baby in your house. And it was not good publicity for the rabbi. We advised the rabbi to go ahead and to get a doctor to prepare everything for the circumcision, and the father would do the actual act, which is done many times with mohels. But no doctor agreed to it. Doctor said, "Either we do it, because we trust ourselves, you're not a surgeon, you can't do it." So ultimately, this particular rabbi asked if we can write a letter to the community saying that the baby is Jewish, and when all is well, we'll give him do this mitzvah, but until then, he's Jewish. So, a very strange request, It's like if Rabbi Friedler would say, can you write me a letter that you can wear a kippah? Or can you write me a letter that we're supposed to keep kosher? I mean, due respect, everybody knows that. What am I going to write? So we did write a letter saying that outside of the world of eating sacrifices, a baby who did not have a bris is 100% Jewish. And then the family said, well, since the baby was born, everyone calls the baby what? What do you call a baby when it's born? A baby, correct?
A baby.
Baby, the baby cried, the baby needs, the baby burped. Well, you know, you can call it a baby for a few days, but this is a month and a half. When do we usually give a name to this baby?
Yeah.
At the bris.
At the bris. But if there's no bris,
so if there's no bris, we felt that the way that he can prove to his community that while a bris is important, that we're going to do it as soon as we can, we have to name the baby before the bris. So they did a whole ceremony via Zoom, naming the baby before the bris. I believe it was the first time
in... We did that too, with our shlichim.
Oh, you did that too. So, again, unprecedented. It doesn't happen usually. But in this case, it indeed happened. As a matter of fact, going back to the case of the baby that died, we all wanted to pray for the baby. So the question was, what do we say to God? Please take care of baby? It's not telling God who we're talking about. So I have to admit, I personally didn't have a problem, because when I had a brother born who was a preemie, I asked my Rebbe, Rav Aharon Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, I asked him what to do, and he said, just say your brother, God knows who you are referring to. God, who can read our hearts and read our minds, doesn't need the name. And that's what I did. In this community, it wouldn't fly. People wouldn't say baby, because every single day people were dying. And this happened to be in New Jersey, New York area. 450 people were dying by day. They had so many people sick that they needed a name. So indeed, we gave the baby a name in this ceremony. Unfortunately, it died. But we did that in Oslo for a totally different reason. That's for PR purposes, to ensure that the community understands that the rabbi's still a rabbi and the baby's still Jewish. As time went on, we began to get questions that, again, unprecedented. We couldn't look at any precedent. And yet, these are laws and regulations that we took out of the attic that were there for many years. We just never needed them. So we have to go ahead and go back to our Jewish Learning 101 to take out views or rules, regulations that we have that we just never utilized. And just to give you an illustration of what I mean, above and beyond what I've mentioned, what I said earlier, let's talk about the following. Thank God we have people that are not dying, and we have people that are getting married. So I recall watching the video of Rabbi Nati and Deb's wedding, and you know how many people were there, and you know how many people danced, and you know how many people enjoyed, and these are all the things that are now forbidden. So if when you got married in August, people held hands and hugged and kissed and were happy. These are all the things you can't do today. As time went on, even in Israel, they said weddings can have up to 5 people. Bride, groom, 2 witnesses, and the rabbi. That's it. Not even parents. Now, according to the rules and regulations of weddings, at the end of the wedding ceremony, before we break the glass, we always say 7 blessings. Those 7 blessings, Sheva Brachot, have to be said with a minyan. There is no minyan here. According to the way the law is codified, you cannot live with your wife without these 7 blessings. So the couple wants to say the 7 blessings. The rabbi can, thank God, read Hebrew when he can say it. He just is not allowed to. Are you still allowed to get married under those circumstances? It's true that with the giving of the ring, you should have a minyan, but even if you don't, the ring giving is fine. But here, you actually need a minyan. So we have to utilize the point of view that basically said it doesn't mean you're not married, it just means you need a chuppah. So there was a chuppah, and it means you go home together, which is the case, but quite frankly, you could get married even without a minyan, just don't say those 7 blessings. Now you have to understand that even though halachically it was very clear to me that that's the answer, the couple was devastated. I mean, they always viewed a wedding as a big ceremony where everyone is so happy and no one's there. They do the chuppah, everyone's wearing a mask, and then they go home. It was the most, I hate to say this, technical wedding in the history of weddings. There's no dancing, there's no singing, there's no music. Oh, there's maybe a photographer. They allowed five people, so they said, two witnesses, bride and groom, one of the two witnesses is the rabbi and a photographer. That's the whole wedding. And they were literally devastated. So what we suggested was, this is not a halachic suggestion, was as follows. People are not allowed to live in their houses, so they can't come to your wedding. Perhaps you're allowed to come to them. Namely, go in your car after the wedding to the various places where your friends live, obviously coordinated, and they'll come out and they'll clap and maybe sing in your honor. So there wasn't 1 ounce of wine other than what they drank under the chuppah. There was no food at this wedding, but they told me afterwards the most joyous, because they went around and they were able to give everyone attention to all the community with their car, and people came out, wished the mazel tov and whatnot. Unfortunately, the idea came to me because of funerals, where people also were not allowed to go to funerals, so the body in the car was taken to people's homes. But this was beautiful, I have to say. People came out of their homes and said mazel tov, and again, they're not getting anything in return. They're not getting a good meal. They're not even getting a good drink, and we all know how important those two things are at a wedding. Let's be honest, none of us will go to weddings if we're not getting food and drink. And they came out of their homes, and they wished a mazel tov to this couple from the bottom of their heart, and they got nothing in return. No food, no drink, nothing. Of course, the question that bothered me was, well, if you went to them as opposed to them coming to you, do you have to give wedding presents under those situations? Or, well, if I get nothing in return, I don't get wedding presents. It turned out 50-50. 50% felt, you don't need to give a wedding present. And the other 50 said, no, you do. So we now have a couple that has a bar mitzvah of their son, and they're going to do the bar mitzvah on Zoom. And it happens to be in a community where, thank God, they went back to shul, but only 10 people are allowed in, or 12 people. So they're going to do it via Zoom. So they started a WhatsApp group, and that's the main question on the WhatsApp group. Do you have to give presents or not? Is being on the computer like being there or not? Is being invited to such a wedding a true invitation? And in return for the invitation, you usually give a present or not? And it's an interesting situation, but I'll just end with this question, because this happens to be a question that is extremely relevant right now. I'm very friendly with Rabbi Friedler. When I see him after a whole month or a year or years, there's a blessing I make. You know what blessing you make when you see a good friend that you're so happy to see? Anyone want to guess? The Chaya Meitim. The Chaya Meitim is if you didn't see him for 12 months.
A year.
But if you saw him, let's say after 30 days, up to a year, you say Shechianu. So here's my question. The community now has not been together for over 2 months. There's rumors that they're going back to shul, so people can actually meet face to face. They saw each other via Zoom, like we're seeing each other right now. Do they still make that blessing? Or they don't. In other words, is a virtual site, like we're doing right now, like seeing someone? Or it's not considered seeing someone unless you see them in person? Is there the same happiness level that here we are, Rabbi Lawrence in London, I'm in Israel, you're in New Zealand, and we're seeing each other, like meeting in person? Or is it different? And I think this is a fundamental question about how we view technology. Because when this is all over, the question that every community is going to deal with is, so do we go back to normal having a minyan in shul? I mean, it was wonderful. I get up in the morning, whenever I feel like it, and I don't have to get all bundled up to go outside. It's cold. I don't have to go into my car. I don't have to look for parking. I just put on my computer and I have a Zoom minyan. So we're going to go back to normal. We're going to see each other in person. The only way that's going to happen is if we assume that seeing each other in person is infinitely greater than via a screen. In other words, if you have...
We already allowed 100 people in the synagogue already.
Mm-hmm. So it's a very relevant question.
Very relevant.
I have to admit that it's extremely relevant, and I have to admit that this will go to be, in my opinion, the most fundamental question after COVID-19. is being, for example, friends on Facebook, a true friend. You know, you chat, they like what you write, you like what they like, what they write. Is that a true friend, or is a true friend someone you actually see in person and go to take a cup of coffee with? That's a fundamental question, and I'll end with the last question I got yesterday. As I said, people are beginning to open up. So a certain shul was allowed 12 people in. They're going to have services over Shavuos. And the rabbi asked, so should I make a bracha? I'm so happy of Shechianu or Hatov HaMeitiv that thank God we got back to shul. I have to admit, I'm debating. On the one hand, you daven together outside. Just like in Israel, there were minyans in parking lots in the open space, minyans in parks and whatnot. You saw each other, albeit, how did you see each other? Everyone was wearing a mask, 2 meters apart, no one's interacting. So is that considered seeing, being with each other? So now you're in shul, but you were outside? Or is going back to shul the true happiness? I'll be honest with you, Rabbi Friedler, my answer I gave was, when all of this is over, and everyone can come back to shul, then we'll ask the question. But just having 12 people in shul, I don't think that's happiness as of yet. 12 people, 2 meters apart, masks, no one's touching each other, no one's shaking hands. I don't think that's the returning to shul, quote unquote, that we're looking for. So I try to give you a few questions from our lab here in Israel. If you have any questions, I'd be very happy to answer if we have time, Rabbi Friedler.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Friedler.
That was unbelievable.
Fascinating. Have a look at the screen. You're getting lots and lots
thank
of
you.
Quiet claps.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That was beautiful. And I think what I took from all those questions and mainly the answers is the compassion and understanding of the uniqueness of each community and what would be relevant for them. So it's not about actually the question, it's who also asking the question, which is not less important. So it's not the same question that you get from Norway onto the very, very religious community in America. So your understanding of the community is really, really important. So we appreciate that, Rabbi Gunstein, for your insights. I don't know if we have
my
any
pleasure.
Questions in the meantime.
In the meantime, people can put in some questions into the chat. But for now, we're going to have a piece from Ilya. Good, we've got him there ready. If you have questions, pop them into the chat while the music's playing. And this is also a very good time to enjoy cheesecake. We've got beautiful cheesecake from the deli.
Nice.
But we invite everybody to have a little something to eat and drink while we enjoy some music. And thank you once again.
My pleasure. It's
we
wonderful.
After the music as well, we're going to be hearing from Yaakov and Leora Levy, and they're going to give us a bit of an update on what they've been doing and teach us about Jewish education.
And of course, Rabbi Gunstein, if you want to stay with us, that will be our honor. If you're busy, of course, feel free to zoom in or out as you wish.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we're back here. Hoffman has just joined me again. He's downstairs practicing on the other piano because he has to do a recording shortly. So it's really busy morning here at Villa.
Namati Dhani.
דני, אתה רוצה את הקשר היום, אני מעריך, נכון? אוקיי. אני מיד גם אסתכל עליו.